We thank you for your word. Thank you for this passage. And we ask you that you help us to understand. Amen. Well, it was yesterday morning when I came back from 3.5 weeks with my mother in Germany, visiting her and spending time in my former hometown of Michelstadt. And whenever I go and see my mother, one of the topics of conversation is changes. You know, which shops in the town have closed, which new shops have opened, whether building projects have now been completed or which new projects have just started. Of course, you would expect any reasonably sizable town to have its changes and to be continually progressing and developing. But more importantly than those outward changes with shops and buildings are the changes of attitude. And something that I found really encouraging, and that happened already nearly 7 years ago, is that Michelstadt, that's the name of my hometown, finally allowed the so-called Stolpersteine to be laid in the town. Stolpersteine, literally translated as stumbling stones, are little brass plaques, little square plaques made of brass, into which are engraved the names of Jewish residents, former residents. And these little plaques are then placed in the pavement, inserted into the pavement, in front of the homes where those Jewish residents used to live. And usually it gives the name, gives their birth date, it gives the day when they were deported by the Nazis, and then also, if known, the day or the year when they actually were killed. So it's an act of remembrance and an act of acknowledging what had happened during the 1930s and particularly the early 1940s during the Nazi dictatorship in Germany. And it was quite a remarkable thing that, you know, it took the town council a good 3 years to actually agree for those Stolpersteine, those stumbling stones, to be laid. Emotions were still running high even after 60 years, but gradually attitudes changed and people were willing to accept what had happened, were willing to acknowledge the victims. Another way where I thought attitudes clearly have changed was something that began in the summer of 2015. You may remember that was the year when millions of refugees from Syria came to Europe, or tried to come into Europe, and where some countries very generously opened their borders to allow people to come and settle. Germany was one of those countries where you had about 1 million of refugees come within the space of 2 or 3 months. And my hometown had several thousand of people arrive. And what I thought was so great and showed that attitudes really have changed was the spirit of welcome that was expressed in the population. People of different ages, different backgrounds, were all very, very sympathetic. And when talking to cousins and to neighbours this summer, it sort of became clear that this spirit of welcome has continued. And as people are now being dispersed from the original centres, as people are settling, taking up work or training, that people, the local population, are still making every effort to try and be as inclusive as possible. And I thought, you know, well, it's great to observe how attitudes can change and how a town can change. And this change of attitude is the topic in our two Bible passages. In Isaiah 56, the change is sort of foreshadowed. Isaiah paints the vision of a Judaism that is inclusive, where the foreigner, yeah, where the Gentile is included and is allowed to integrate and is accepted as part of the worshipping community, which stood in great contrast to the more exclusive Judaism that was practiced at his time. And this sort of inclusivity theme is then continued in the gospel passage from Matthew chapter 15. Many commentators regard this passage as quite difficult, and it certainly is a passage that goes against the grain, that seems to cause a lot of objections, that is not very easy to digest and to take. And just for those who are interested in this, when I was sort of researching and thinking about the passage, I also searched on the internet, and by entering Matthew 15 verses 21 to 26 into Google, it came up with a lot of different results, commentaries and so on. And one of the links that was shown was to an article that had appeared in the Huffington Post, in the online version. Yeah, I was a bit skeptical when I saw it, but the Huffington Post seemed to have a very good, regular, sort of devotional column. And there was an article written on this passage by an American female Lutheran pastor, and what she had to say made a lot of sense to me. And so if you are interested, I'm going to tell you what she said in detail, but if you're interested, please just Google the passage and then it should lead you to this article. Anyway, there are a number of controversial things, number of awkward things in this passage. And the first one that the reader would have noticed is the fact that Jesus and the disciples are said to have gone to Tyre and Sidon. It's a region which we now call Lebanon. And the people who lived there were not Jews, but they were pagans. And their normal name, the name that's mentioned here as well, is they are Canaanites. And the Canaanites were the already mentioned in the Old Testament. And they are mentioned there as the enemies of the people of Israel. They had settled in the country, in the area, and when the Israelites came back from the exile in Egypt, came back from the at the time of the Exodus, the Canaanites had to be driven out of the country so that the Israelites could resettle in the land of their ancestors. Then in the Old Testament it says that God had promised them victory and that the Canaanites would be defeated. But since then, ever since, they were regarded as the enemies, as the opponents of Judaism. So it's in enemy territory, yeah, that Jesus and the disciples have gone into. You may sort of wonder, you know, well, what possessed them to go there? Was there any sort of urgent need? Certainly wasn't that they went there by accident. They didn't just sort of stumble across by mistake, you know, taking an unnecessary detour. There was a point behind it, a point that is gradually unfolding as the story is told. Yeah, a change in attitude that is meant to be picked up. Now, the second thing that is sort of controversial and goes against the grain in this story is Jesus is being approached by a woman. Not only in Israel, but in the whole of the region, it was expected at the time that women should be silent, that they should be keep themselves in the background. And certainly a woman would not speak out, would not address a stranger, would not address a man, unless she was a prostitute. They were the only ones who would actually approach strange men and talk to them. But here a woman is approaching Jesus, is speaking to him, acting in a rather suspicious way, allowing doubts to be cast on her reputation. Now we can imagine, or we can quite easily sympathize, I think, with the woman and understand why she was doing something that is so scandalous. She wasn't actually doing this for her own sake. She was doing it because her daughter was seriously ill and she wanted her daughter to receive help. And I think we can understand this as a very strong motivation. And all of you, or any of you who are parents, would probably agree with this and say, yes, we do anything for our children. And if our children are in need, if something has happened and they need help, no matter how old they are, we would say, yes, of course we are there to help. We would try and put anything and everything into motion in order to help them. So this woman and her actions, her seemingly scandalous way of behaving, was just driven by her deep love for her daughter. And now we come to the third point of scandal. The bit that really goes against the grain. The bit that is initially quite difficult to understand, and we wonder why. And this is looking at Jesus' response. So there is this desperate woman approaching Jesus, asking him to heal. And what does Jesus do? Nothing. He is silent. He doesn't answer. Now this is quite shocking. And in our day and age, in the 21st century, we would call it giving someone the silent treatment. If somebody talks to you and approaches you and you don't acknowledge them, you don't answer, that is the deepest insult that you could actually give to a person. The deepest rejection, not even worthy of an answer. The silent treatment. Certainly the disciples took it in that way. They clearly thought that that woman was not worthy of an answer. That, they considered her, as the subsequent remarks by the disciples show, just as a nuisance. And then, the next scandal, the next thing that rubs and we don't really like, is when Jesus actually speaks. He says, well, I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. It looks rather exclusive. Jesus only serving one group. Doesn't fit in with our picture of Jesus. But then there could be far more behind this. We need to ask ourselves, who are the lost sheep of Israel? How can we tell who is part of this? Now, if we think of some of the parables that Jesus told, we think of the parable of the wheat and the weeds, we find that the parable tells us, well, we need to let both grow. and they need to grow up together. We can't distinguish. It's for God to then pass the judgment, not for us. If we look at the parable of the sheep and the goats, just by looking at the sheep and the goats, we can't tell who will deserve punishment and who will get the reward. It's God who knows. So maybe being sent to the lost sheep of Israel, it's not for the disciples, it's not for us to judge who are the lost sheep of Israel. But God knows. And the lost sheep of Israel may be more than just belonging, the people belonging to one nation. It could be anyone. The woman is persistent. She does not take no as an answer. And then comes the next, even more scandalous thing. The answer that Jesus gives her when he speaks the second time. It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. And the word dogs here is actually used as a word of insult. It's used in a derogatory term, just like we in English use the word bitch as a swear word. So it's quite a shocking, quite a harsh reply that Jesus gives. But the woman makes a quick riposte. And she says, yes, it's right. You know, the children need to be fed first. But the dogs eat the crumbs from under the table. We actually, incidentally, echo these words in the BCP communion service in the prayer of humble access, where the whole congregation acknowledges and agrees that we all are not worthy, not even worthy to go to eat the crumbs from under your table. But then it says, but one word, and you grant us access. Now what the woman, by her riposte, it's not just a quick, witty remark, but what she indicates, maybe, is that God's grace is so big, is so overwhelming, that even just a tiny crumb of that grace is already sufficient, and is sufficient to make her daughter well, to heal. Yeah, that even if only just a tiny bit is spared, God's amazing grace is just all too wonderful, and it covers, even a small bit covers far more than we can ever imagine. And so Jesus, in the end, finally recognizes the faith, acknowledges the faith, and acknowledges and rewards the persistence of the woman, and her request is granted. Now, the thing that I find striking here is the Jesus saying, you have great faith. But nowhere does the woman actually declare her faith. Yes, she addresses Jesus in the correct terms, calls him Lord and calls him Son of David. But she doesn't then sing God's praises. She doesn't pour out saying, I love you more than anything. There is no explicit statement of faith, no recital of any form of the creed. Yeah, she hadn't been through an Alpha course or anything like this. It's interesting. It's a kind of implied faith. It's implicit rather than explicit. But Jesus acknowledges it and is there and builds on it, rewards it. Then the second bit, we need to be quite careful when looking at this answer, is the you have great faith, your request is granted. We mustn't get hung up about this idea of having a great faith. We focus too much on this, we can drive ourselves crazy, questioning, whether our faith is great enough, whether we would have a great faith. Now we mustn't go down that road, because otherwise, you know, you could really lose the plot by saying, well, if I had had more faith, then my prayers might have been answered. And even worse, if I had had more faith, my prayers would have been answered and person X would have been healed, or they would not have died, or whatever. I mean, it's just the wrong avenue to go down. We mustn't sort of focus on that one word too much. What I think is much more the focus of this story, of this healing, of this episode, is the change of attitude that it's pointing towards. The change of attitude towards the non-Israelite. The inclusiveness of the gospel. Now here, the woman, the one who was a Canaanite, yeah, from the opponents, from the enemy of Christ, she is the one who is accepted and whose faith is recognized. It's a change in attitude towards the other that this story is guiding us and making us think. And it comes in these sort of stages. It looks almost as if Jesus has to think about this. It looks almost as if he is changing his attitude. Not quite sure whether that's the case, but certainly his sort of staged response makes the disciples think. It's meant to help them change their attitudes. And the application of this passage, I think, is clear. What the writer or editor of Matthew's Gospel wants his predominantly Jewish audience to understand is that Christianity bridges the divides that exist in society. That each generation has their own outcasts, has their group which is rejected, be it ethnicities, be it religions. And what this story tells us is that faith can be found in the most unlikely places, where we would least expect it. Yes, there may be more faith in Jesus amongst those of other religions than we might expect. The story points to a change of heart, a change of mindset in the listener. And it encourages an openness towards others, an inclusivity, rather than a stubborn holding on to boundaries.